KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, Right to Survive, Breaking the Chains, will play Thursday, July 14th at 7 p.m. The night will give an inside perspective of the struggles of the houseless community and showcase a series of short films documenting Right to Survive's origins in 2009, Direct Actions, and its annual Pitch a Tent Campout, which protests the city's hypocrisy when it comes to allowing sidewalk camping for the Rose Parade. Many of the Right to Survive board members will also share their experiences and talk about the process of moving to their new location. Again, that's Right to Survive, Breaking the Chains, Thursday, July 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune into KBOO for our 25-hour fundraising extravaganza of special programming and community celebration. Tune in at 8 a.m. for Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty. Her guest will be retired Seattle City Council member Nick Licata, author of the new book, Becoming a Citizen Activist, Stories, Strategies, and Advice for Changing Our World. Again, that's 6 a.m. on July 14th through 7 a.m. on July 15th to support your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
The time is 5 p.m. and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio. Coming up next is the evening news. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Step House Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. More information about Step House internet services is available at 503-548-2000, or information can be found online at stephouse.net.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the monthly vigil honoring a young black man killed by Portland police is tonight at the spot where Keaton Otis was killed in 2010. We speak with Joanne Hardesty about where the police accountability process is on that.
Sanders endorses Clinton.
And Portland school board member Paul Anthony has filed a civil rights complaint against the district on behalf of kids. KBOO's Don Merrill speaks with him about what's at stake. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 12th, 2016. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jamani Ward-Lewis. Bernie Sanders endorsed Hillary Clinton for president today after thanking 13 million Americans who voted for him in the primaries. He also thanked the 2.5 million people who donated to his campaign. Sanders noted that Clinton goes into the convention with 389 more pledged delegates than he has, and a lot more superdelegates. Tune in to KBOO during the Democratic and Republican primaries over the next 2 weeks for live Pacifica coverage hosted by KPFA's Mitch Josrich.
Last week, Mohammed Mohamud, the former Oregon State University student convicted of terrorism, had an appeal hearing. Last week, I spoke with Attorney Thomas Nelson about what's going on the case of Yonas Fikre, another young black man allegedly entrapped by federal officials as part of the so-called war on terrorism. Fikre is suing the FBI for placing him on the no-fly list to force him to collaborate with officials seeking to prosecute Mohammed Mohamud. Tune into the KBOO Evening News next week for the full interview.
Yeah, let me back and start with Fikre, because I knew of Mr. Fikre before I knew of the Mohammed Mohamud connection. Mr. Fikre is a Eritrean person who is in Khartoum and pursuing business interests there when a couple of FBI agents from Portland, Oregon showed up and basically deceived him into coming to the embassy in order to be interviewed. He thought he was going for a lunch to talk about security. When he got there, the FBI agents told him, we want to talk to you, and we want you to become a confidential informant on a case that is developing in Portland, Oregon, and we will pay you a lot of money, and you will have a good life, and come on back. There was no mention of what the case was. He asked that, and they said, well, if you want to know that, you're going to have to meet us in I think, Amsterdam, where we can go into this further. And he thought about it, and he said, no, I don't want to do it. They said, well, think about it. He wanted to get out of the meeting. The meeting lasted quite a while. And addressed issues arising at the Portland, Oregon mosque, Masjid al-Sabr. He told them, yeah, I want to leave. And they said, well, let's meet tomorrow and we'll pursue this further. He agreed to a meeting. However, at that point, after he left, he called the FBI agent, David Nordelus, and said, I'm not coming. I don't want any part of this. I want to go on about my business interests. After that, he left, and about a year later, he was in the United Arab Emirates, where he was pursuing similar business interests, and he was apprehended and taken into custody by the secret police of the United Arab Emirates and held incommunicado for a number of days while a search was going on for him. During that period and later, he was tortured. He was held in custody for 106 days total. He had been told by Agent Nordelus in Khartoum that he's on the no-fly list. But when the UAE decided to release Mr. Fikre without charge, saying they didn't have anything against him, they said, you're going to have to leave the UAE for at least 6 months and probably a year. That's standard protocol for people we've detained like this who are not UAE citizens. So he said, fine. They said, okay, we'll get you a ticket back to the United States. They went to get him a ticket back to the United States, and they were told that they couldn't fly him to the United States because he's on the U.S. no-fly list. And they said, well, you have to pick a country. So Mr. Fikre, who fortunately had a distant relative in Sweden, said, well, send me to Sweden where I know some people. So they bought him a ticket to Sweden. After the 106 days of torture, Mr. Fikre was quite upset, lost many, many pounds, worse for wear. He got there, and he decided to seek asylum in Sweden and obtained a local lawyer there, an excellent individual by the name of Hans Bredberg. And at that point, I was also representing Mr. Fikre. The asylum request was ultimately denied, and Mr. Fikre said, okay, what do I do? And they said, we'll fly back to the United States. And then that didn't work because he's still on the no-fly list. So the Swedish government at that point said, okay, we will get you back by our own means, and they chartered a jet to fly from Stockholm to Portland with a stop in Reykjavik, Iceland. And so Mr. Fikre arrived in the United States about a year and a half ago, and he's been living here since. He's since married, and he's now living up in Seattle. The reason I mention this is Mr. Fikre, when he got back, we initiated litigation, number one, to challenge his being on the no-fly list, and number two, to raise a bunch of surveillance issues, very similar to the Mohamud case. Now, we think that Mr. Fikre was the intended confidential informant in the Mohamud case, but of course Mr. Fikre told the Department of Justice, the FBI, that he didn't want any part of that. So anyway, I think there's a nexus there between Fikre and Mr. Mohamud, because before Mr. Fikre had left for the Africa and then the Middle East, Mr. Fikre was acquainted with, wasn't a close friend or anything, but was acquainted with Mr. Mohamud. Right now, Mr. Fikre has a case pending in front of Judge Anna Brown in the Federal District Court in Portland dealing with the issue of surveillance, and specifically violations of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and, more importantly, the Fourth Amendment. Mr. Fikre knows that he was targeted by the United States, by the NSA, because in litigation against him, there was criminal litigation, criminal proceeding in San Diego, since dismissed. He was told that they had eavesdropped, had intercepted his communications. I think the government, frankly, knew that it was been caught off base when the lawyer for his brother said, wait a minute, you guys are violating the Constitution and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
With KBOO News, I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
The problem of lead in drinking water is getting a fresh look in Corvallis this week. Yesterday, the city reported it has closed four drinking fountains because of high lead levels. The fountains are at Village Green Park, Little Fields Park, Riverfront Park, and Lily Park. Officials reported they received the lead test results on July 8th, and the decision was made that day to shut down the drinking fountains. They will conduct additional testing to confirm the elevated lead levels. Lead typically enters the water supply by leaching from older pipes or fixtures that contain lead. Some water pipes are still made of copper, but Congress banned lead solders, pipes, and fittings in 1986.
A special event tomorrow at the Clinton Street Theater benefits the Right to Dream 2, the Right to Dream Camp, through screening two films about their work. KBOO spoke with Lisa Faye Mubarak this afternoon about the films and what else is scheduled at the benefit.
The event's called Breaking the Chain. It's at the Clinton Street Theater. It'll be from 7 to 9:30. And what it's about is actually two 30-minute films and some live entertainment, some musicians as well. The first one is how Right to Survive began Right to Dream 2. And a little bit about how we came from the idea of needing a rest area, a place for people to stay, to what it is today, from conception to present. And the second film is about our big annual Pitch a Tent event. We recently had our sixth one, very successful. A lot of turnout. Over 110 tents that we were able to put houseless people in, as well as our allies and supporters coming out for the event. So back to Thursday at the Clinton Street Theater, we will have Riddy open up with a 10 to 15 minute performance. Then we'll show our film, our first film. And then we will have a little Q&A session with members from Right to Survive. And then we will continue on the night with a performance by Queen Bead. And she does like a Jamaican Caribbean flavor type music. She's awesome. And then we'll show our second film. The first film was done by Colin Pratt, who is a longtime supporter of Right to Survive. The second film and the MC for the night was done by Elisa Christensen of Portland Burn Survivors, who's also a longtime supporter of Right to Survive. And then we'll end the show with Mike Crenshaw performing to play out the night.
Lisa Faye, when I think of what is a political legacy of Right to Dream and Right to Survive, what strikes me is that over all the years, and I mean decades now, that yourself, your family has been agitating around this issue. You've always been on the cutting edge. You've always been running ahead of and warning people, this is happening. Do something now. Can you speak to that a little? I don't want to steal thunder from the documentaries, but can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, yes, Right to Survive was created because we found in the houseless community that there was a need for people to have a voice, to have their opinions heard, to have an organization outside of the social services that really advocated for them and spoke up for the houseless people's rights. So with the Houseless Bill of Rights going back into legislation in 2017, we're continuing to do our part to advocate for a more just world for the houseless community.
All right. Lisa Faye Mubarak, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Lisa Loving. Always a pleasure here at KBOO.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
There appears to be some evidence that the Portland housing market is cooling down at last. According to data, analysis firm XEO Metrics, Portland area rent went down 3.3% in the second quarter as compared with the first. It is still the fourth highest rental market in the nation at present, behind Sacramento, Seattle, and Phoenix. Meanwhile, the new Hassalo on 8th development just added 657 rental units in the Lloyd Center. Another new development in progress at 1400 Northeast Multnomah will add 689 more units and 39,000 square feet of rental space on a site that is currently a parking lot.
Keaton Otis was shot to death by Portland police near the Lloyd Center in 2010. Police say they pulled him over because he wore a hoodie and sped away from them when they moved their vehicle behind his. Tonight is the monthly Keaton Otis Vigil, starting at 6 p.m. and held at the street corner where he was killed, Northeast 6th and Halsey. Here to talk, thanks for being here, Joanne.
It's my pleasure.
First, can you recount what happened to Keaton that night on May 12th in 2010?
Yes, May 12th, 2010, around 6 p.m., Keaton Otis was driving his mother's car near Lloyd Center. Gang enforcement officers in plain clothes pulled up behind him and noticed him and said that he, because he had a hoodie on and what they considered a very warm day, because he was driving a car that didn't appear to fit him, they started following him. And as what happens with most people, if you're being followed by the police, you're going to make a mistake. And so he changed lanes without signaling, and that was their reason for pulling him over. Once they pulled him over, the situation escalated almost immediately. And within a matter of a couple of minutes, he had been tased three times by three different officers. He had been shot 26 times. And the police version of what happened was when they pulled him over, they say he became belligerent and started cursing him out. They say he reached into a glove compartment, pulled out a Crown Royal bag, opened a Crown Royal bag, shot Officer Humphreys in a leg, and then sat on the pistol. He did all that while being tased by three different officers and then being shot 26 times. And the community, needless to say, does not share that view that that's what happened to Keaton Otis.
So that same year, Portland police killed another young black man in a mental health crisis named Aaron Campbell.
Yes.
Can you talk about that case as well? For people who moved here recently, what happened there?
Well, 3 months before Keaton Otis was killed, Aaron Campbell's brother died that day. He had been suffering from kidney failure, and so that day he died. Aaron Campbell was distraught with the loss of his brother, in his apartment, his girlfriend's mother called Portland police because she said she had been trying to reach her daughter and her daughter wasn't responding. And she was concerned that that Aaron Campbell may have had a weapon and he may have been distraught and wanted the police to go and do a welfare check. So they did. They showed up at Aaron Campbell's apartment building. A hostage negotiator was talking to Aaron Campbell. They were texting. He got Aaron Campbell to let everybody else in the apartment go. He wasn't holding anybody hostage, but there were other people, but they were allowed to leave the apartment. Aaron Campbell started coming out of the apartment, following the officer's orders, coming out backwards with his hands up. A Portland police officer then released his dog, which started biting him on the ankle. So when he moved, another police officer went, he's reaching for a weapon. And Officer McAllister was up on a rooftop and saw him reaching back because first there was a dog, then somebody tased him. So he went to go to his back because he was tased. And so he put his hand to his back. Police officer, sharpshooter, decided he's reaching for a weapon and shot and killed him. Now, the sad thing about this is the officer that had the rifle and who shot and killed him wasn't even in communications with the officers that were directly at the scene. Those officers said the incident is over, everything's under control, he's coming out, there's no problem. But because that officer chose to take his earplug out, he didn't know that the situation was under control. So there therefore he shot and killed Erin Campbell. And as you may know, that officer was fired by Portland Police Bureau, stayed on paid leave for 5 years as we went through an appeals process, and he now is in a Portland Police uniform again, back on the force, all back pay, all seniority. So it's as if Erin Campbell was not killed, but he was.
So 2 years later, the U.S. Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against the city of Portland based on the police bureau's use of force against against people in mental health crises, but they didn't call out violence against Black people as an issue that the bureau needed to act on. Right. Why do you think this is?
Well, ironically, when the Alberta Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform invited the Department of Justice to town, it was specifically to look at what was happening with Black boys and men at the hands of Portland police. When the Department of Justice showed up, they did a bait and switch and decided that they would investigate what was happening with people with mental health issues. When we asked them why they did the bait and switch, they had two reasons. One, you may know that at the U.S. Supreme Court, you cannot bring a case of racially biased treatment unless you can prove intent. And that played out in New York with the stop and frisk. If it wasn't for brave officers recording roll call where they were told to go out and stop Black and brown boys and men, stop and frisk would have never stopped in New York. The second reason they told us, which we found more egregious, was the men who had been killed by Portland police who were Black all had mental health issues. So the mental health cover would address the African-American people who were killed by the police.
As a community activist who has served in the Oregon State Legislature, what do you think is wrong with the police system of accountability in the state and in Portland? And how does it compare to other parts of the country that you're familiar with?
Well, I think policing is broken all across the United States of America. I think in Oregon specifically, we cannot pass good legislation to hold police accountable because currently in our legislative body on the judiciary committees are many ex-police officers. And so when you try to pass really good reform measures, for example, there was a body cam bill that was a good bill when it started last legislative session. And when it passed by a unanimous vote of both houses, it was the worst possible bill imaginable because it did just the opposite of holding police accountable. So the bill that the legislative body passed, the police would own the data. The public would have no access to the data. The police would decide what was released to the public. The police could look at the video before they wrote their written report. And so anybody who thinks that we're looking for accountability in our police would not look at that as a model for an action. What we need in Portland specifically is a really independent police review process. Right now we have a pretend process with the IPR. They don't actually investigate police. They don't hold them accountable and they throw out 74% of complaints they get in every year. So as a community member seeking redress, you cannot get that today unless you can afford a private attorney that's willing to sue Portland Police Bureau.
For our listeners, can you talk about what the IPR is?
Oh yes, IPR is the Independent Police Review Division that's out of the auditor's office. Put together by Mayor Vera Katz during her administration that was supposed to replace the past oversight body, which all the members resigned because they felt that they were not being allowed to do the job that they were hired to do, which was to hold the police accountable. And so the IPR supposedly investigates and police misconduct. But as I said, when you throw out 74% of the complaints that walk in your door every year, and you throw them out because people are houseless, because they're complaining about racially biased treatment. And basically IPR says, well, you know, it's just a he said, she said, right? You say they treated you bad. He says he didn't. We can't do anything about that. And so we have an incompetent system that's set up to pretend that we have oversight of police, and we don't. And so we need to get rid of that pretend system and put a real system in place that's led by the community, that has subpoena power, that has a budget. I mean, we could take the IAD, police investigative division's budget, since they don't investigate police well, and we could fund a really independent police oversight board. And that's what I think we need to do.
And it doesn't seem to be a matter of availability of funds either, correct?
Certainly not. I mean, you know, that's the powers that be will tell us that we don't have the money to put a truly independent police resource in place. But if we took the money from the IPR's budget and took the money from the IAD, which is the internal police investigative unit that is supposed to investigate police and don't, if we took both of those budgets, we'd have significant money for the public to be able to hold police accountable for their behavior.
What, in your view, is, I guess, what are some of the biggest obstacles to achieving an independent police review system?
Well, the biggest one is police think they do nothing wrong. And so how do you correct behavior if you've done nothing wrong? In the case of Aaron Campbell, in the case of Keep Notice, police officers have not been held accountable. And we have many, many cases in this community of community members. I mean, you think about, there's so many cases of people that have been killed or harmed by police where there's been no accountability. They haven't been punished. They haven't been fired. So we have to fix. I think that's one of our biggest problems. So the biggest problem is the police are going to say, we do nothing wrong and we know best. And so we don't need any oversight from the public. The other obstacle is that we have a very incompetent city council that actually refuses to hold the police accountable and to make them responsive to the public. And so we need a new city council. We need an independent police process that the public owns. And I have seen, I know that in Oakland, California, they did just that. They took the money from the police who were supposed to be doing investigations of police, and they actually created a community oversight board that actually is funded by the money that used to go to the police department. And they are starting to show results of a very effective community-led oversight body. And so I use them as a model of what's possible.
Wow. Well, that's reassuring that in some part of, I guess, this side of the country, There's a little bit of hope.
There is a little bit of hope. And I mean, and every community is actually responding differently. So depending upon what community you live in, what grassroots people are really pushing policymakers to make changes. And it takes it all. You have to have grassroots folks on the street. You got to have policymakers that are willing to hold police accountable. And if not, then we have to be willing to remove those policymakers.
I feel like we could sit here and talk about this for hours.
All day long, but I have a vigil to get to, yes.
Yes, yeah, and that's what I want to bring it back to, bringing it back to Keep Notice.
Yes.
What will happen at the vigil tonight, and what can you tell our listeners about it?
I can tell you that the month after Keep Notice was killed, his dad, Fred Bryant, started this vigil, and his dad... as you can imagine, all family members are devastated when their family member is killed by anybody, but especially if they're killed by people who are sworn to protect and serve. And so he started this vigil for 1 hour every month on the day his son was killed from 6 to 7. And so tonight we will gather. We will talk about what's happening now at the state of policing. And of course, as you can imagine, over the last week, a lot has happened around the country. So we'll be talking about what our next steps are here locally and how we can be supportive of each other. And I want to also do a shout out to Serge, because Serge actually did a fabulous press conference yesterday to encourage people to come to the vigil. And they've done a wonderful job of actually supporting the Keep Notice vigil. And I want to say that Fred Bryant died almost 3 years ago now, 3 years ago in October, because his heart gave out and seeking justice for his son. And Walita and I decided that we would keep this vigil going because we made that promise to him. And so as long as we have a breath in our body, on the 12th of every month, we're there on that corner.
Well, thank you so much for setting aside the time to come and speak with us about such a really saddening issue.
Yes, but I have hope because people show up every single month. And what I love, even the months that I'm running late and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, am I going to get there? Am I going to get there? I turn the corner and I see the love that's displayed on that sidewalk. And I know we're doing the right thing. And ultimately, we're going to be successful because we believe in justice and we believe in justice for everybody. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much. I've been speaking with Joanne Hardesty. Find the Keep Notice Vigil page on Facebook. And for more on the City of Portland's DOJ settlement process, go to www.cocl-coab.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Preference, hosted by Alan Silver, followed by Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective at 7. Tomorrow's weather is partly sunny with highs near 80 degrees. East of the Cascades and Hood River, it'll be partly cloudy with highs around 70 degrees. Today in history, in 2001, Abner Luma, a Haitian immigrant and electrical engineer who was sodomized by officers in a New York City police station, agreed to an $8.7 million settlement. The quote of the day is from Abner, who said, "What happened to me should not happen to any human being, to my children, or to anyone else's children."
It is 5:30. Time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
No doubt you'll be thrilled to learn that we now live and work in a gig economy. That's the latest corporate buzz phrase from Silicon Valley. CEOs are hailing a brave new workplace in which we lucky worker bees no longer have to be stuck in traditional jobs with traditional hours, traditional middle-class pay scales, traditional benefits, traditional job security, and all those other fusty traditionals of the old workplace. In fact, in the gig economy, you don't even get a workplace. Rather, you'll be liberated to work in a series of short-term jobs in many places, always being on call through a mobile app on your iPhone or through a temp agency. How exciting is that? Well, they use exciting in the sense of distressing and nerve-wracking. The gig economy means you're on your own. You're not an employee, but, quote, an independent contractor with no rights and no union. You might have lots of calls to work this week, but there'll be many weeks with no calls. Don't get sick or injured, for no health care or workers' comp are provided. A pension? Your retirement plan is called Adios Chump. This alternative work arrangement is not a futuristic concept. It's already here and spreading fast. Some 16% of U.S. workers are now in this on-call, temporary, part-time, low-pay, you're-on-your-own economy, up from only 10% a decade ago. Corporate chieftains, backed by the economists and politicians they purchase, are creating what they call a workforce of non-employees for one reason: greed. It directly transfers more money and power from workaday families into the coffers of moneyed elites. This is Jim Hightower saying their gig economy is aptly named, for gigs are crude four-hook fishing devices that are drugged by commercial fleets through schools of fish to impale them, haul them in, and cash in on the pain.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Today, 250 interest groups led by the Center for Biological Diversity filed a historic petition to halt all new fossil fuel leasing on federal lands. The petition arrives in tandem with a new report, Overleased, How Production Horizons of Already Leased Federal Fossil Fuels Outlast Global Carbon Budget. According to the report, if we are to avoid the worst effects of climate change, emission rates must decline steeply and immediately. In addition to ending new leases, a significant percentage of fossil fuels already leased must be kept in the ground in order to meet global carbon budgets. These measures are necessary to meet climate change goals agreed to by the U.S. and 194 other countries in the 2015 Paris Agreement. The U.S. was the top global oil and gas producer in 2014, and only China extracts more coal.
The U.S. Senate voted 63-30 last week, passing Bill S-764 that will eliminate mandatory labeling of GMO foods. In 2014, Vermont passed a bill that went into effect July 1st, requiring labels on genetically engineered foods. In addition, several national companies like Campbell's, Mars, and Kellogg's have already issued GMO labels on all their foods. The new measure will halt such progress. The new law will override Vermont and any other state's laws requiring identification of GMO foods. Rather than clear labeling, the bill will allow food companies like Monsanto to instead use identification codes, which can be read by smartphones. Those against the measure worry that this is jeopardizing the ability of consumers to stay informed. Jeff Merkley and Bernie Sanders both openly oppose the bill. Polls show that an overwhelming majority of Americans support GMO labeling. Many such Oregonians say that corporate interests are at play again, as they were for State Measure 92 in 2014, which would have required labeling in Oregon.
And now we check in with Stevie Alpin, a journalist exploring the legacy of colonialism through a trip back to his roots in Puerto Rico. Read all his writings on his blog, I Will Not Obey, on blogspot.com.
People that are for the junta think that the junta will come here to basically make the politicians of the island pay for their wrongdoings, and that is a false assumption. Basically, they keep on repeating the same things, that the same types of disinformation that make people think that this junta is coming against the politicians and not against their best interests. But I believe that my position is not that to say that the people are ignorant, because I don't think that the problem is like a problem of ignorance. It's a problem of a lack of alternatives, of political and social alternatives. People are, what that is saying is that people are not feeling represented by their authorities. People are not feeling that the way that things have been done in the last years have represented their best interests, and they see this as a change. It is important that we be able to combat these discourses, and that in the years that are to come, which this junta will be governing, that we will be able to make explicit the way in which this junta is not just a reformulation of colonialism, but a continuation of the same types of policies. In a sense, it changes our relationship with the United States and our relationship, our colonial relationship, but in another way, it is a continuation of what has been done for years. And it is important that this movement, in the way in which it approaches the public, be able to express that in the most clear way possible, that we are not just against the junta, we are against the bipartisan system, we're against colonialism, and we're against austerity politics. It's really important that the international community be vocal and denounce the U.S. government for their incompliance with international law, and for all the damages that they have done to the people of Puerto Rico. Environmental damages because of military bases, like in Vieques. They went away from Vieques in the beginnings of the decade of the 2000s, but they didn't establish a program, a well-funded program for reparations of the island. There are still toxic elements in the waters and in the lands of that island. The cancer rate in Vieques explicitly, which is a little island located on the coast of, on the eastern coast of Puerto Rico. Yes, there are people living on the island. Those people have inadequate access to health, inadequate access to transportation to the island, most of them because of, after the closing of the military bases, which provided a lot of jobs for them, the U.S. government didn't make themselves responsible for creating incentives for local jobs in the place. So these people have to move from the island to the mainland. These trips are costly. These trips are uncomfortable. They have closed schools and hospitals in the place. So many people have to move from the island on boat to get to their basic services. Those types of reparations have not been made by the U.S. government. Other types of reparation have to do with debt. Our second demand is that we do not recognize the legitimacy of the debt, the public debt, because it was made by an illegal and an illegitimate form of government. Because of that, the responsibility for such debt has to be taken by the United States government as part of the processes of reparation. The case of Puerto Rico cannot basically withhold another decade of silence, which we basically have been having since the 50s. It is important that we understand that silence is complicity with colonial rule, and that colonial rule is not just illegal under all international laws, but also it is a regime of exploitation and of domination of people There is no possible democracy under colonial rule. There is no possibility of actually building alternatives within colonial rule. And we believe that this movement could be a space in which a new opposition to colonialism that goes beyond traditional independence movements, which has been, which their rhetoric has been basically a lot of folklore with the images of what being Puerto Rican means. I believe that in my position, this is not a pro-independence camp. It is a anti-colonial, pro self-determination camp. But my position for independence is that the independence movement has to present itself as a social alternative and not just a cultural alternative. The issue is not if we're Puerto Rican or not. We are Puerto Ricans under colonial rule. We will be Puerto Ricans even if we annex to the United States and become a state. And we will be Puerto Ricans if we become independent. The issue is not our identity. The issue is the rights and the possibilities of democracy for the people in Puerto Rico. And I believe that for independence to actually be able to gain mass approval, it has to not only come with all these nationalist images, but also with a social project that will be in the benefit of the most vulnerable sectors of the society and the large majorities.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imc.org for Monday, July 11th, 2016. Israeli forces destroy farmlands to expand settlement in the West Bank and tanks in the border areas in Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli army forces on Monday raised Palestinian-owned lands near the village of Na'lin near Ramallah in central occupied West Bank, according to local sources. Witnesses told local news that Israeli soldiers, accompanied by bulldozers, broke into the area and flattened the land in order to expand the nearby illegal Israeli settlement of Nili. According to a report by the Applied Research Institute, ARIJ, the consecutive Israeli governments adopted a policy of acquire occupied West Bank lands to the purpose of building and expanding Israeli settlements by employing different methods, most renowned of which is security, which is also how Israel was able to restrict Palestinian towns' development on the remaining areas. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers invaded overnight, and on Monday morning, several districts in the occupied West Bank searched many homes and kidnapped 14 Palestinians. The Palestinian Prisoner Society, PPS, has reported that soldiers kidnapped six Palestinians in a number of towns in the southern West Bank district of Hebron. The Nablus office of the PPS in the northern part of the occupied West Bank has reported that soldiers also invaded various communities in the district and kidnapped four Palestinians. Also in northern West Bank, troops searched and ransacked homes and kidnapped two men from the city of Tul Karim. In Bethlehem, soldiers invaded Aida refugee camp north of the city, searched homes and kidnapped two Palestinians. Moreover, several Israeli military vehicles invaded on Monday at dawn Palestinian agricultural lands east of Khan Yunis city in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Eyewitnesses said that four Israeli tanks and three bulldozers advanced more than 150 meters into Palestinian lands, bulldozed some of them, and installed sand hills close to the border fence. They added that the Israeli vehicles came from the Kisufim military base across the border fence and fired many smoke bombs during the invasion. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, July 11th, 2016, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Mayer, John Paccio, Tony Longshanks, Don Merrill, Kanan Schlesinger, and Danielle Beaker. The producer is Lisa Loving. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jamani Ward-Lewis.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Paul Rowland speaks with longtime climate activist and writer Patrick Mazza about his hunger strike for climate justice on the steps of the Capitol in Olympia, Washington. At 9, we speak with local activist Sandy Polishuk of 350 PDX about efforts to get the state of Oregon, Metro, and other governing bodies to divest from fossil fuels. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio.